Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today, my guests will be Professor Allison McClatchy from Claflin University and Ms. Davetta Green, who is from Catholic Hill, South Carolina. We're going to be talking about Catholic Hill, South Carolina, which is located just outside Walterboro, and it is a predominantly African-American community centered around a Roman Catholic church. That, in South Carolina, folks, is unique. I'll have that conversation, but first, your NPR news break. Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Dr. Allison McClatchy, who is on the faculty at Claflin University, and Mr. Vetta Green, who is from Walterboro and a member of St. James the Greater Roman Catholic Church. And we're going to talk about a community called Catholic Hill, its origins, which are very interesting and, quite frankly, not known to a whole lot of folks. So first of all, ladies, welcome to the journal.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. McClatchy, how did you get involved with this project? Because that's how I first found out about it.
Well, when I was a graduate student at USC in the anthropology program, a friend of mine who was also in the program, Lisa Randall, she was working at that time at Historic Columbia Foundation. She knew about the community and she took me down and we went for a visit and we met with community members. And I forget if it was an event that we went for or if we just went, but it just seemed to be a very fascinating place to find this small enclave of Black Catholics in the middle of the Lowcountry. And I had never heard of the community before, and I was fascinated by it.
That is very intriguing because, first of all, Roman Catholics are a very small percentage of the population in South Carolina to begin with. And then to talk about a congregation of Black Roman Catholics, especially in the rural Lowcountry, is even more intriguing. And you have a double fascination in terms of your training. You have an anthropology degree and a sociology degree.
Yeah. And so for me, myself also a Roman Catholic, I'll tell you a story. When I got to the United States, I came to study at South Carolina State.
And where did you come from?
I came from Trinidad,
okay.
Where we have a large Roman Catholic population. It's about a quarter of the population. And so I came here, and one of the first questions I asked the officer, the person in charge of international students, was, where's the Catholic Church? And she looked at me, and then she looked at a colleague of hers that was in the office, and she said, I don't think we have a Black one of those. So I, of course, was just flabbergasted. And I said, I didn't know you needed a Black one. I learned then that Black Catholics were a novelty. Mm. And so to then learn about this community, and that was when Lisa and I went there, was probably 2003, mm-hmm. 2002. It was interesting to me. And then as I learned about it, and, you know, I was busy being a student, so I wasn't able to go back to the community until fairly recently. About a year ago, I reestablished contact. And, it was just really interesting to me because, you know, where I come from, it's not unusual to find people of different faiths and different ethnicities.
And, of course, historically, until after the American Revolution, Catholics were not allowed in South Carolina. We know that there were some that were secretly, but by law, they could not settle in South Carolina. That changed after the Revolution. Ms. Green, your Catholic Hill begins, that story begins not too far after the Revolution, right?
Right.
Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it all started, supposedly as I know of, the Irish that settled there, they had slaves. And during the war, when the war broke out, some of the Irish left. And
when the war you're talking about, the Civil War.
The Civil War, yes, sir. And some of the Irish stayed and some of the Irish left. And the slaves were left behind. So when with the slaves being left behind, they carried on the faith of the Catholic Church because no priest was left there to help carry on the religion of the Catholic Church. So, as I say, the slaves carried on the religion of the church.
And actually, the Catholic bishop at that time, Bishop Lynch, mm-hmm. was one of the many clergymen of various denominations who justified slavery. He was tried to be the official representative of the Confederacy to the Vatican, unsuccessfully, but he did try. So you've got this small group of Black Catholics out from Walterboro and this church, and it's in the history of the Catholic Church, they officially, in Charleston in 1867, opened a black church.
Yes.
But what I'm hearing from you is that St. James the Greater really was, it became a black Catholic church during and after the Civil War and remained such.
Yes.
It actually, the first physical church was established in 1854, right? So what we do know is that these Irish folks, most of them came from Charleston because there was this large or significant anti-Catholic sentiment in Charleston. So these folks migrated into Walterboro and the surrounding areas. And of course, as Miss Green says, you know, whatever religion the master was, so were his mm-hmm. or her slaves. And these Irish settlers, when they left, they had taught their slaves enough about Catholicism that the slaves, well, the former slaves, held on to the faith.
Okay. Now, there was no official support from the church at this point. The community is worshiping on its own.
Right.
Yeah, led by laymen in the community who would call the community together on Sundays, and they would say prayers. You know, the great thing about being Catholic is, you know, we have a whole list of prayers that we tend to know by heart. They would say prayers and they would sing hymns, and, you know, they would then go back to their homes after that. And that was done for a number of years until the bishop in Charleston remembered that the community was there.
Yes.
And that was about 1897.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the parish got a resident priest.
Yes.
A school is a big part of this story as well, correct?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. Miss Green, let's talk about that, because your family for generations has been a part of the Catholic Hill community. In fact, you live on Catholic Hill.
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. So let's go back and, you know, to the 1890s and talk about the school and the church and your folks.
Okay. Back in the 1800s, different slave children and all were reared up in the schoolhouse. My mom and my uncles, they were also in attendance at the schoolhouse. Miss Edwards and Miss Washington, Miss Grant were three teachers that were in attendance at the school for the children at that time.
Were these women African-American as well?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Yes, sir. They were. Yes, okay. Sir. They also had children in the school at mm-hmm. that time also. After desegregation, that's when the schoolhouse actually closed as far as children attending, because the children were then able to go to school in town, because at that time they weren't allowed to attend the school, the public schools that were in town. So
the schools continued to operate until the 1960s?
Yes, yes.
Okay. That's part of the South Carolina story, is that all denominations, for the most part, in South Carolina, including the Catholics, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, maintained segregated schools until the 1960s, and then the color barrier was dropped in the parochial schools, Catholic and Episcopalian, before it was really dropped much in the public schools. But once the public schools were open to persons of color, that's when many of the denominational, predominantly black schools closed.
Right. And also, a lot of people don't know it, except for us that live in the area. They also had a Catholic school called St. Anthony Catholic School in Walterboro for the children that attend school in Catholic Hill, because a lot of them weren't going to the public schools. They attended the Catholic school that was in Walterboro.
So when what had been the white Catholic school in Walterboro opened up, between that and the public schools, that was the kind of the death knell of the school at Catholic Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I think that there was a conscious decision, I don't know, that there would be one school serving the community, because it's about a 20-minute drive from
yes.
Catholic Hill to Walterboro. And these schools took, the Catholic schools took the kids up through middle school age.
Yes.
And then before desegregation and after, the students would then go on to high school, Colleton County High
yes.
School. And there are actually a number of women from the community who went to the boarding school, the Catholic boarding school in Sumter, including Mrs. Davis's mother. And these were young women who were identified by the parish priests or maybe the school teachers And were sent on to Sumter to boarding school, to the high school there for boarding.
And what was the name of that high school in
Sumter? I think it's St. Anne's High School.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that was the name
okay.
of it.
All right. So that's a very interesting part of the story because the Diocese of Charleston did desegregate in 1963. That's very early on in South mm-hmm. Carolina. And so that made a change, as you're saying, in the community. So there was one Catholic school instead of one for black and one for whites.
Mm-hmm. It was only one.
So what happens after there's no longer any need for that schoolhouse?
Well, it was a need because we used the schoolhouse for the youth in the area. When I was coming up, we would have little fashion shows, talent shows, because we had a youth organization formed for the community, for the children, the youth in the community. So the building was still being used, and also for free lunch. Mm-hmm. During the summer, it was used. We also would still use it for the women's club meeting, Christmas parties. It was still being used until about 2001, when termites and stuff started getting the better of the building, and the floor and stuff started to decay, so we could no longer use the building. It was considered condemned, so we couldn't use it.
So it really was a community center.
Yes.
Which, for those who study old-fashioned parish histories, is the parish house. That's exactly what it was intended
yes.
for, was a community center, not just a Sunday school building.
Right.
Right. And I think when you look at the geography of where the church and the schoolhouse are, you know, and I heard all these stories that when that bell tolled, people from the community just knew something was happening, and let's get to the church. The church and the schoolhouse are next to each other. And so people would just assemble to find out what happened. Maybe it was somebody's passing. Maybe it was something else that was significant. But the physical location, because it's at a crossroad, was very important.
Yes, because the tolling of the bell twice meant that someone died. That's usually the main time that they would toll the bell, or either if it's a storm or something, they'll do the bell. But twice, when the bell is rung twice, it's for death.
Speaking of storms, looking back at the history of the church, the first church building was destroyed by fire.
Mm-hmm, right.
Then it was rebuilt. A storm did destroy that building
yes.
as well. But the congregation rebuilt a third time.
Yes.
And is that the present church, the 1897?
The present church, yes, it is.
And I've seen colored illustrations of that church. It's absolutely beautiful inside with that painting of St. Peter Claver.
Yes.
Yeah, and we have no idea how that painting got there.
Okay. Why don't we explain why that particular painting is important for this community, the story it tells?
Well, it's St. Peter Claver administering to the slaves. And he's one of the patron saints of slaves. So it's significant in that here is a representation of someone who is reaching out and reaching to people who are enslaved. And, of course, many of the community members are descendants of slaves themselves.
And, of course, that's the very message of the New Testament. There's no slave, there's no free.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful painting, but also it's a very powerful
It's extremely
message.
Powerful. And that's, again, going back to my fascination with the community, just this whole idea of why would you choose to remain Catholic in this instance when this was the religion of your enslavers? And you had choices. I mean, if you come to the community, you would drive through and you'd notice that they're Methodists. Churches there, you know, this is not an isolated insular place, even though it's rural. So folks had choices, but obviously there was something that they made a decision, individuals made a decision to remain Catholic, in some instances to convert to Catholicism. And when we talk about the role of the school, we know that there were people who weren't Catholic, but would send their children mm-hmm. to the school because it was an opportunity for an education, and conversion was not demanded of them. Mm-hmm. you know, in fact, I heard a number of stories that said, you know, for the kid who was Protestant that went to the church, they were doubly unlucky in that they had to go to whatever Catholic service there was on Sunday and then afterwards go to Protestant services as well, because the parents just wanted, they wanted the experience, the whole experience of education for their children. And I think that's one of the things that I'm learning as I learn more about the community, just the importance of that schoolhouse and the opportunity for education.
Well, the comment that you made about the fact that why do they stay with the religion of their and those who had enslaved them? Because in most other denominations, as soon as emancipation came, Black South Carolinians walked out of the churches. Mm-hmm. Now, in some cases, they had Black Presbyterian and Black Episcopal churches, but in many cases they went to things like the African Methodist Episcopal Church and the Black Baptist Church, mm-hmm. which was different from the Southern Baptist Church. So the fact that they remained, and it also it's not only Catholics a very small percentage of the population, but for them to stay with a religion that, quite frankly, a lot of Carolinians, Black and white, didn't really know a lot about and kind of distrustful of.
Yeah, and for some in some instances, still don't know a lot about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is something that's, and again, just from my position of coming from a place where this was normal to me. Mm-hmm. And so I continue to be fascinated by the strength of the community and their story.
Ladies, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Allison McClatchy from Claflin University and Ms. Devetta Green from Catholic Hill about Catholic Hill, South Carolina. Now, the study that you're doing of this community is officially an ethnography. Explain that for us lay folks.
Well, I'm very fascinated by issues of identity. Right. So what I've tried to do, what I'm trying to do with this study is look at it historically as well as in its contemporary context. Look at geography, look at migration patterns. So I'm trying to write the story of the community, but not just using one particular lens, but using multiple lenses. And so the best way I can describe that is just the story of the community as complete as I can.
Well, how large is the community now? How many parishioners at St. James the Greater?
Over the years, it's died down some. So I'll say about 45 parishioners.
For a rural church in South Carolina, regardless of the denomination, that's a pretty familiar story. Mostly older folks, or clearly that does not apply to you.
No, not mostly older folks. It's a mixture. It's a mixture.
And has that been because people have left the faith? Are they, in many cases, people moved to the big city? They moved to Charleston and Columbia?
Yeah, because some of them have moved to different areas. Either some have moved on to different denominations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
What I found, one of the things that I found is that you see that there was a pattern of out-migration for a lot of these folks, because what were their options in rural South Carolina? And seeing, and I haven't quite had time to explore it as yet, but I'm seeing many of the men joined the military, mm-hmm. and many also, men and women, migrated to places like Chicago and New York and many cities, not just Charleston or Sumter, for example, because they were looking for opportunities. And there seemed to be an informal network of former residents of Catholic Hill who were in New York or Chicago or D.C. or wherever. And, you know, as people graduated school, would then move and go up and meet these folks and work there.
That is a pattern in South Carolina beginning in the early 20th century. Got to talk about the last century in the early 20th century, but it certainly increased in the 1920s and 1930s for economic opportunity and because of the weight of segregation. Mm-hmm. And so they did. And yes, once somebody went north, an aunt or an uncle or a cousin, there were the connections and it was opportunity.
Yeah.
Have any of those folks come back? Because that's another story in South Carolina in the 21st century is the return of some of those who left South Carolina, particularly African-Americans who have returned, older folks who've returned.
Yes. A lot of them have returned and a lot of them have built homes in the area on family land and stuff. So, yes, a lot of have returned home.
That's the other side of that great migration, Black Carolinians returning home.
Yeah.
In fact, in the census now, there's a net gain of Black population. You know, if you look at out-migration, in-migration, there's a net gain. And a lot of that is folks, as they say, coming back home.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to rural communities where they have the family tie.
Yes.
Not to the big city. The younger folks are going to the big city,
yes.
Going to Columbia or Greenville or Charleston. But the older folks, there's that pull of family that brings them back there. And I think that's, Dr. McClatchy, that's going to be an incredible part of this story.
I think so, too. One of the participants, you know, because I was spending days down there, living down there, and one of them said to me, well, you know, there's an Italian restaurant in Walterboro. And she said, yes, my niece owns it. I was fascinated. So this woman, her niece, obviously owns a restaurant, or I don't know if she's the sole owner or part owner of the restaurant, an Italian restaurant. So you walk into an Italian restaurant in the middle of Walterboro that's owned by a Black woman. So I was just fascinated by that.
Well, I mean, that's the cultural transfer from New York or Chicago or Philadelphia.
Right.
Philadelphia was another big market mm-hmm. for African-Americans from South Carolina to go to.
So you're correct. So there's this idea of people returning home or returning to what is perceived to be home, even if they didn't grow up there. But this is where their roots are. And then I also heard stories of folks whose siblings or other relatives passed away and wanted to be buried in Catholic Hill, had their lot picked out and demanded that they be brought home even after death.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's another thing that we were able to do with the community that they wanted done, working with a student, Olivia Adams, at the College of Charleston, an undergraduate archaeology student. She did some GPS mapping of the church graveyard because, of course, you know, gravestones fade over time and they're destroyed. And so she was able to prepare a GPS report stating where all the graves were. Hopefully that would be something that we can finish up pretty soon for the community, because it's important to know who's where.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what about the parish records? How good are they?
The parish records, we haven't delved into them too much. We're visiting the archives for the diocese in Charleston, mm-hmm. And we've been working through some of those things. But, you know, because of the fires and the tornadoes and priests coming and going, a lot of the records have been lost. Some of them have been sent down to Charleston. This community and this project is, you know, the more I get into it, the more I see what I need to learn.
The diocese has some records?
They do. They do have some records. And, you know, many members of the community that I've met have been really very helpful, not just in terms of giving me opportunities to interview them, but some of them have their own family albums and notebooks that they come and they share with us as well. So there's a lot to unpack still. One of the projects that we did was we scanned a number of photographs, I think over 300 photographs that the community had. But a lot of those people in the photographs we've lost names for them. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we did with these scanned photographs is we just put them up in the hall, hoping that if people stopped in, they would just identify or you know, say, well, this is this person and this is this person.
Have you got a website for the project?
Not as yet. You know, I'm a sociologist.
Well, you know, this may be where one of your students might come in handy, because seriously, with those photographs, if you put them up on the web, there may be somebody who's searching for family and can find it. And the other thing about the graveyard is those names need to be posted online, too, because there's a website where – or I'm sorry, a search engine where people search for graveyards and to try to find their forebears. And so all of that – yeah. Somebody may remember my great-grandmother came from South Carolina somewhere. And if you've got your graveyard listed in that graveyard registry, wow, I found her. She was at – grew up in Catholic Hill near Walterboro, South Carolina. So, ladies, I suggest, you know, get somebody, make use of the Internet, because this can – these are where people can help you that are no longer in the community.
You know, and one of the things is, you know, I got a few random calls from people like, I heard you're doing a project. And people have been really very helpful that way. And for me, like I say, it's about this idea of home. It's about this idea of where and how do we see ourselves? Where's our home? And so, you know, there's a story about the religious aspect of that. There's a story about the school that I think it's very important. Some of what I'm learning, and Devita kind of talked about it a little bit, is, you know, for many of these people living in Catholic Hill, they weren't sharecroppers. You know, they were living on their own land.
Well, see, that's an even more important part of the story. And when you're talking about the church, the land, the place, Southerners, regardless of race or class, have very much an attachment to place, which is why those folks are migrating back to
home.
To home.
Yeah. And I think for Black rural community, you know, a lot of us hear on the news, you know, there's the stereotype of you know, the way African Americans are stereotyped, because it's an easy stereotype to go to. And so for me, what's fascinating is here's a community that does not quite fit that, you know.
Ooh, I'd say you understate. It doesn't fit at all.
and I'm not trying to negate the problems of segregation and racism and classism and all the isms that exist. But what, you know, what I find fascinating is here's a community that found a way, as we would say in social sciences, to claim their agency, right? And they own their own land, so they would work their land. But they would also, when it was harvest time on a large plantation, go work there too, because it was a source of income, right? And I heard many stories of people who would go and work, and they would use that money to pay for their books or buy things that they needed. And you hear all these stories about racism and the Klan and those kind of things. And I asked my interviewees, now maybe it was an age difference, you know, in terms of generational. But, you know, they said that it wasn't that they were unaware of racism, but they felt, by and large, they were insulated from it. And part of it, I think, has to do with the ruralness of the community, but also the closeness of the community.
Is Catholic Hill predominantly African-American?
It is.
Okay.
It is. But the other thing is, too, that for me, I said I was asking questions particular because they had white priests and nuns and brothers who came down from up north, you know, and so how did that interaction go? And the folks that I interviewed at least said they did not get a sense of, they didn't get any kind of racist experiences from these folks who were outsiders for the most part. You know, a lot of them came up from up north.
All right, did they live in Catholic Hill or in Walterboro? The priest and the nuns, obviously associated with the school.
They lived in Walterboro.
You said the drive is about 20 minutes?
Yes.
So to me, it's all these things that together, I'm just fascinated by how a community survives and how a community sees itself in the greater picture.
Ms. Green, since you've been involved with this study, have you learned something about your community that you didn't know before?
Yes. I learned about the slaves and the slave owners. I learned that the slave owners gave the property to the slaves. The slaves, upon gaining the access to the property, the ownership to the property, that's how they were able to farm the land and build their homes and stuff, because, like I said, the slave owners left the property to them once they left the Irish. Mm-hmm. Once they left the property to the slaves. And that was very interesting to me, because I always wonder how, because my great-grandfather owned a good bit of the property around the area, and they were telling me how he, with the goodness of his heart, would give property away. Mm-hmm. I either sell it, but the majority of it he would give to people, you know, who needed property or whatnot. So, yes.
Well, again, the fact that the black landowners, there were black landowners in South Carolina.
Yes.
But the fact that most of the people in this community were landowners is unusual. That, the Roman Catholic, they don't fit any of the patterns, Professor.
None at all. And one of these random phone calls that I got was actually from a descendant of one of these white settlers, you know, who was very proud of a connection to the community.
We'll talk about that for a minute.
You know, because what's fascinating to me, and putting on my sociologist's hat, I'm thinking, like you said, if you're a Catholic in South Carolina, you're a minority, regardless of your ethnic origin. And so, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about people who recognize that they are in a minority, and remembering that connection that you have with other minorities. So there are a number of people who live near to Walterboro, or who remember their connection, their connection to Catholic Hill. And this very generous woman called me up, and she said, you know, I'm a descendant, and when you can, let's get together and let's talk about these connections, you know. And it's really fascinating to me, because I think a lot of people still don't know about Catholic Hill, but when they do discover it, they stop in to worship with them, and they're fascinated by not just the story of the historic story, but also the community that's there now. Yeah.
Well, that is a tremendous potential, the descendants of those white Irish settlers. Again, that's where the internet's going to come in handy. seriously, because they may have letters, diaries, which would describe the founding of this.
And I know that this is something that you would probably know quite a bit about, you know. And again, I'm a sociologist pretending to be a historian sometimes. But their names like Bellinger and Pinckney, McCain, these are all surnames of white Irish who had settled there. And some of them weren't, some of the settlers in and around Catholic Hill, some of them were Catholic, and even some of the white ones were not necessarily Catholics, but their wife would have converted for one reason or the other. Mm-hmm. So I'm recognizing that there are some names there that are significant to South Carolina history in general, but I still have to spend a lot of time kind of learning about who these folks were.
If I still had graduate students, if I was still, because this, first of all, I know that the archives of the Diocese of Charleston are particularly rich, mm-hmm. and the folks there are wonderfully cooperative.
Fantastic.
The South Carolina Historical Society may have some information. The Colleton County Historical Society, which is still active, may have, and Walterboro may have some information. So, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but again, I really recommend if you can get somebody to create a website for this project. Or Facebook.
I think we have. I spent 6 weeks this summer because I was lucky enough to get a small grant from Claflin, where I work, to do the initial kind of study. Mm-hmm. And so this is when we spent the time doing the cemetery and doing the photographs and conducting these initial interviews. And, you know, I say we because I'm collaborating really with community members. We know that we have a whole lot more to do. And I'm hoping that they're going to keep me around for a little while because I see so much that needs to be done still.
Well, another suggestion before we talk about what needs to be done is, Ms. Green, you might want to have the parish contact the Humanities Council South Carolina for a pilot grant and then talk about. Have you already done that?
I'm actually having my student. I sent her an assignment. That's her assignment to help me work on putting together that grant, because now that the schoolhouse has been restored and, you know, the community worked really hard to get that schoolhouse restored, what we want to do is use some of these photographs that we've found and mount a kind of permanent exhibit so that when folks stop in, mm-hmm. whether they are returning for a family reunion or just driving through and notice the church, that they will have something to read and learn mm-hmm. about the community.
Ladies, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Allison McClatchy from Claflin University and Ms. Devetta Green from Catholic Hill about Catholic Hill, South Carolina. I almost forgot an important part of this story is the timber from the school, mm-hmm. and we didn't get into that mm-hmm. because it's almost a miracle.
It is.
You had mentioned, Ms. Green, that the building was in decay and it was going to be dismantled, but the congregation had salvaged a trailer load of the original heart pine timbers.
Right.
Because, of
yes,
course, termites don't eat heart pine.
Right.
And then one night, what happened?
One night, the trailer was stolen with the wood. Then Father Kendall, at the time, had gotten a call saying that the wood was found. Well, we found the wood, but we didn't find the wood, trailer that the wood was on. The wood was placed on side of the highway, but we never retrieved the trailer.
But the most precious was returned.
Yes, the precious part. Father was going to build. If you go into church, if you look at the original pictures, the altar, the way the altar was in the original photo compared to the altar now, he was going to rebuild the old altar with that wood. Mm-hmm. But he never got a chance to, because right now Father Kendall is not with us right now. He's out on his little adventure, so right now he's not with us.
He's taking a sabbatical.
Yes.
Okay.
So.
Sabbaticals are not little adventures.
Well, he's when I spoke to him, he told me he was doing that that pilgrimage that starts mm-hmm. in France, and you walk your way through France to Spain.
To Santiago.
Yes.
Yes.
I have been to the cathedral at Santiago. I did not walk there, but I have been there, and I have been to St. James' tomb.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so I think he needed a bit of a rest.
He did. He did, because he accomplished a lot in the short period of time that he was there. But we're waiting for him to come back because we know he's coming back to finish.
So the plan is to use the timbers from that original school.
Yes.
To build an altar.
Rebuild the altar back to where it was, the original altar.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
But you have also rebuilt the school.
Yes, sir. We rebuilt the school. The original staircase that's inside the building, they moved that. So in order to go upstairs, it's totally remodeled, totally different, but it's beautiful. It really is. And it has the original downstairs, the walls and stuff of the schoolhouse. And the ceilings.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's once again a community center.
Right.
Okay.
Use it as a hall for celebrations like baptism and confirmation, you know, afterwards and whatnot.
All right. A few minutes ago, we were talking about things that needed to be done.
Yes.
Let's start cataloging those. Because what I'm thinking about is there may be people in our listener audience who may be able to help you out. So let's talk about both of you. Let's start with you, Professor, and talk about things you think need to be done. And then Ms. Green, or not just need to be, but want to be done. Okay?
Right. So you're correct. We need a website. We need a website. And one of the things that we really do want to do is put up that cemetery, that map of the cemetery, so that people, when they're searching for their relatives, can find them. We do want to have some photographs up there just to tell the story of the community. We know that there is a graduate student at USC in history who's working to get the community placed on the federal registry.
Or the National Registry.
Because it is on the South Carolina Registry. Mm-hmm. And so she's working to do that. And we're also trying just to, we're going to be looking at patterns of migration. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep collecting my interviews because I'm not just interested, for example, in people who live at Catholic Hill, but also folks who've moved away or people who were not Catholic necessarily, but grew up there or grew up Catholic and then converted. For my own project, I'm interested in what does it mean to be from the hill? What does it mean as an individual?
Okay. Is it just Ms. Green, did you just refer to it as the hill when you were growing up?
No, we refer to it as Catholic Hill.
I like the shorthands.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure So it's again, I think in rural South Carolina, to call a place Catholic Hill is still just an incredible piece of history.
Yes.
So there's still a lot of academic work to be done. But I think for DaVita, there's a lot of work still to be done in the community itself.
Yes. For most part, our church roof, it needs to be repaired. Inside the church, from it being such an old building, it's starting to have little cracks. The cracks have been there a while, but now, you know, the weather playing a big part in it, we have different insects and different things, you know, starting to come in and affecting the exterior of the building. Inside is carpet, but it's hardwood floors on the floor. But the carpet is covering it.
Maybe those carpets ought to be taken up because of hardwood
floors. That's what we're planning on doing. Right now, they have it on the whole. That's one of Father Kendall's projects also. He wanted to go ahead and pull up the rug, but after he took a leave of absence, it's on the whole. So,
yeah, one of the things that DaVita hasn't said is Father Kendall did spend a lot of time, I think he wrote for a grant,
yes,
to try to help restore the building. But the choir, the Catholic Hill Choir, her mom is a member of, went from throughout South Carolina,
yes,
parish to parish, singing and raising money to restore that building. And I think that's what they're doing now,
yes,
for the roof as well. So these folks, again, they've worked hard, you know, not just if we think about as a community that was forgotten, maintaining their faith on their own. But even today, these folks continue to work hard to make sure that this place remains there for the community?
We formed different groups in the church. And it was fun because we were like battling one another who can raise the most money. But we were helping each other, but also having different kind of fundraisers. So that's how we got the majority of our money. When it got where we couldn't accumulate the rest, that's when Father Kendall went to the diocese. So the majority of it is from us with fundraisers because we wanted to get our schoolhouse restored back. So we did every means that we could to get it accomplished.
So you did the singing? Did you have?
Yeah, singing, the choir.
Cake bake sales.
Whatever you name, we did it. Fish fries, dinners, the whole nine yards.
And when you do that, the folks who come are beyond the Catholic Hill Convention.
Yes, yes. They were.
Well, see, that's a wonderful part of the story, too.
Yes.
That's a rural South Carolina story, is
yes.
You pitch in and help everybody, regardless of your denomination. If your friends are having a fish fry, everybody comes and buys. First of all, it's going to be a great treat. But
yeah. Because we even had a car show. We had it last year. People from everywhere. I mean, cars, any type of car you can name was out there. And we made a good sum of money from that, too.
And you mentioned the rural community life. And one of the things that, again, that I became fascinated with, and I know nothing about, is I didn't know there was this thing called revival. And one of the community members told me that this apparently is a Protestant event, and there's a campground. And folks go there, I think, in October or maybe November, and they have revivals, and they stay there for maybe about 4 or 5 days at a time, you know. And it may be run by a particular denomination, but just people in the area go to campground.
Yes, there are, you know, the campgrounds around South Carolina. There used to be dozens of them. They're now very, very few. Ladies, I earlier asked Miss Green what she has learned from this, and Professor McClatchy, I'd like to ask you, if you had to share one story that you're taking away from this project so far, what would that be?
One story. Well, you know, of all the interviews that I conducted, I kept hearing about two particular individuals, Joe Poon and Mrs. Washington. Mrs. Washington was the long-serving school teacher, I think, for more than 40 years.
40 years? Okay.
She was a school teacher at the community, and I was able to read in the archives that she was actually sent to the community from the diocesan office. The bishop hired her and sent her along. And, you know, I would hear stories that she would come up on a Sunday afternoon and stay for the week. And then sometimes, I think she was from Charleston originally and would go back. But there are lots of people who have stories about Mrs. Washington and her generosity and her kindness. And then there was Joe Poon, who ran one of the two stores in the community. And time again, I heard stories of, we would go to his store and our parents would send us to get some rice. But somehow he would know that we needed a little bit extra, and he would put something else in the package, and we won't know about it until we got home. So just these stories of particularly these two individuals. There were others, but particularly these two. And that store still stands physically. It's closed, but it still stands physically there. Just, you know, again, coming back to this idea of where's home and what makes home home. And it's people like these, and it, you know, doesn't matter who you are, but for most of us, we have an idea of where home is and the people that made home. So that, to me, you know, it reminded me of, you know, because I have stories like that from my own childhood. So it reminded me of that.
I hope that listeners have learned something. I know I have learned something from this project, and we will put up your contact information, Professor, on our website so that if individuals have something they want to share.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
They can.
Yeah.
All right. Always give our guests a last word. Miss Green, have you got any last words for our listeners?
I would like to say that being raised in Catholic Hill, I enjoyed my childhood. Every child in Catholic Hill was considered a child in everyone's household, considered their own as their own child. There was no child who was not able to go to another person's house and not be able to get anything to eat, drink, or anything. Everybody there in the neighborhood is family.
Professor McClatchy, it was all one community.
Well, you know, I hope what people, for me, what people learn from this project is that there is much to be learned from where we are. Mm-hmm. You know, that that we need to appreciate where we are, where we've come from, and this, you know, the story of Catholic Hill, I think, is or could be the story of many small communities, or maybe even neighborhoods in urban centers. You know, we all come from somewhere, and we all know where our home is. So for me, that's what I've learned.
Okay. Well, Professor Allison McClatchy and Ms. Davetta Green, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on the Journal.
Thank you so much.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's Journal. As it is sometimes with any number of guests, I learned something. I didn't know about Catholic Hill until a while back. Professor Allison McClatchy from Claflin sent me an email. It is a fascinating story historically, but also in terms of the congregation's desire to continue to serve the community in the 21st century. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed by the guests on Walter Edgar's Journal are their own and not necessarily those of South Carolina ETV Radio.